Hello, welcome to a Third Apron podcast. I'm your host, Yossi Goslin, NBA salary cap analyst, and this is another offseason review. Joining me to talk about the Phoenix Suns, as always, is Gerald Bourguet. We're going to talk about all the moves that they did, compare what we thought they would do, because we were actually pretty spot on a lot of these things, and just give our thoughts on the offseason. That is all coming up. Gerald, thank you for joining me again. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Yossi. How about you?
Doing all right. Interesting timing for this, because a lot of ownership stuff in the news recently. We see the Suns with whatever financial stuff is going on there. The Lakers just made a very controversial, surprising, shocking sale. The Clippers are still fighting the allegations laid against them. I mean, the Warriors haven't really done anything bad, but it's just like kind of an embarrassing offseason. Just they couldn't get their guys. The Sacramento Kings having the least embarrassing ownership situation was not on my offseason bingo card.
No, I think that's a fair summary of everything that's going on with these teams in the Pacific Division. A lot of stuff going on with ownership these days, and it feels like the teams in the Pacific are trying to one-up each other with all this stuff going on this offseason.
Yeah, and it seems like the Blazers are maybe trying to join the Pacific Division with the way ownership's functioning there. All the owners on the coast.
He's got to sell the team, right? Can he just sell the team? Can they make him sell the team? Because he's going to try and relocate them. It's really uncomfortable what's going on in Portland right now.
I mean, I don't know what's really going on. Seems like it's just about how are these guys going to maximize as much money as possible? That's what it seems like. If it means staying in Portland, then they'll stay. We'll see what happens there. That one's a pretty sad situation. Yeah. We'll see. Like, based on what's going on in Portland and Phoenix, like to see that the Lakers sold again before that was. That was crazy. We'll find out more what happened there. But that's enough on ownership. We're here to talk about what the Suns did in the offseason. So like I always do in this format, I am going to take out the cap sheet, and we're going to go over step by step what the Suns did. I'll explain how they did each move with the salary cap perspective. With the Suns, their moves were a lot more straightforward than most. And when I go through this, I will bring up some of the projections, some of the trades that we discuss as an example. So when Gerald joined for the offseason preview, we basically did an exercise where we did contract projections for their top free agents and the type of trades we could see them moving to fulfill certain goals and what we thought that we could see them doing. So just kind of a reminder of how they started from a cap perspective. Not a very big payroll with 11 players, about $162 million. However, they do have a lot of dead money inflating that amount and eliminating a lot of their flexibility. So about $186 million in total salaries leave them just about $15 million below the tax with three roster spots to fill. So a couple things. When we did our exercise, we knew that just bringing in like two of their free agents was going to put them into the tax. And we felt that as a team that they're not going to be a championship contender. They'll be a pretty good team, that it probably would have been in the best long-term interest to standard the tax, because they ducked it last year. If they ducked it one more time, if they duck it this upcoming season, then they get out of the repeater tax for the next 3 years. And that's pretty important for a team that has a willingness to spend to be able to spend sustainably. So we'll go over what ended up happening. But essentially, the big thresholds are the aprons, because as they started making moves, it was kind of unclear which apron they'd be adhering to. It ended up being the second apron. So all they really cared about was staying within the 221.7. So with about $36 million to spend, that's plenty of flexibility to bring everyone back, make their moves. Three significant free agents, as we discussed, Mark Williams, he was restricted. And then they have Colin Gillespie and Jordan Goodwin. And then as a team that ended up operating above the first apron but below the second apron, They had the tax mid-level exception, and they had a couple other trade exceptions. However, they are unable to use them because they are above the first apron. So that's mostly it. Just they're limited. They're motivated to field the most competitive team as possible, they're essentially limited to re-signing their own guys, using the tax mid-level. And then when they do trades, they got to do 100% matching. So that's basically the guidelines. Any thoughts on all that?
No, it made sense, and it was kind of what we predicted would be the case. Not a super active offseason, and honestly, the trade that they made was a little bit more ambitious than I expected, even though it was pretty similar to the one that we laid out with Santi Aldama.
Yeah, so we'll get into each one. And then here's just like another cap sheet. Just they did the Koa P trade. That was like technically the first thing they did, even though not in reported order. Traded 3 seconds. It was number 47, and then a 2029 and 2033 second round pick for the 30th pick in the draft. They didn't have to do any salary matching. Well, you don't have to do that for draft picks. You could just absorb them. So it increased their payroll, but they could just absorb it. The draft rights, they brought him down to 2 seconds left, but then they got one more in the Miles Bridges trade. So just simple transaction there. So first big thing they did was agree to terms with Colin Gillespie. And this was actually the first free agent move, I believe, as far as the window in which teams could negotiate with their own free agents, get them and lock them down ahead of hitting the market. And it was interesting how I was surprised at how this came like a week after the finals ended. Usually we have moves like maybe a couple days after the finals ended, and the NBA just, I guess nothing was done. And this would ended up being the first thing done about a week later. So I think like not even just us, I think the general consensus heading into the offseason viewed Gillespie as like at least an $11 to $12 million player a year. I predicted 4 for $50. Suns ended up giving him 4 for $48. So basically right on the projection. He had early bird rights, so they could have given him, since he had two separate one-year contracts, he's able to re-sign with them for about 4 for $68. So they give him this amount, which is kind of in line with like pretty high-end backup guard money. A lot of people were shocked by this in the sense that they felt he should have gotten more or could have gotten more if he tested the market. That was like, I guess, after seeing this deal and then maybe as the market shook out, seeing what role players ended up getting. He actually ended up getting like one of the bigger contracts for a reserve and some of the most guaranteed money. There's like a lot of guys that basically only got like 1 year guaranteed on their deal. So yeah, I mean, where do you stand on this deal? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think it's a great deal for Phoenix. I think there were some people initially that were surprised by the amount that he got. I wasn't one of them. We had talked about this on the show. Our projections were really close to what actually wound up happening. And I think it's good money for, like you said, a high-end backup or a guy who, you know, if Jalen Green is hurt again or if you're dealing with injuries, can be a spot starter. Like Gillespie started the majority of the games that he appeared in last season, had a career year, set the franchise record for made threes in a single season, and shot above 40% from three. Like he's a good player. He's a little bit limited by his size at times, but he's scrappy defensively. I thought this was pretty good value to bring him back and reward him for the growth that he showed in Phoenix without going too far overboard and hurting your flexibility down the line. That contract would be pretty easy to move, I think, especially if he has another good year, if you do need to move him further down the line for whatever reason, or put together a trade for, you know, a better player, whatever you want to do there. So I think it's a good move, and I was not surprised by it. He probably could have gotten maybe a little bit more from someone else, maybe, but I think it was, he wanted to be in Phoenix. He understands the, you know, the value of the fans here and having a career year here, playing for Jordan Ott, all that good stuff. So I think it made sense for both sides.
So even though this is basically where I thought it would land, I'll be a little contrarian just after seeing how some of these other deals for role players went out. I don't necessarily agree with like the length. I like the annual value. Suns tend to reward their role players with after strong seasons, if they had like positive impacts behind the scenes, there's like a lot of players they've done that for. So, you know, like definitely one of the better spots to be in if you're not a starting level player. At the same time, to what you said, I figure this deal should age fine. It'll take him through his age 30 season, still making less than a lot of other reserve guards out there. So I don't think you're going to have like, you know, positive trade value. Like they're not going to get like a haul. I don't know if they'd ever get like a first round pick for him. Unless maybe he has a year where he finishes like high in sixth man of the year voting or something like that. But like it should be movable at the very least if they need to, if something happens. I'm just a little worried about how, you know, the Grayson Allen deal and the Royce O'Neal deals went, giving them long deals like that. So that's where my fears are coming to mind. But this deal is, it seems like far less as far as a percentage of a cap than those ones. So I'm a little more optimistic on those in that sense, on this one in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's the type of deal you can trade and like get positive value back on. But if you're trying to construct a trade for a bigger piece or just need to move some things around, it's certainly not a deal that's going to hurt you in your attempts to do that, I think.
So they gave him the full 8% raises. And this is a common thing they did with all their contracts. They, you know, you agree to the amount, the total value, and then what the Suns did, it's like, I guess, so my co-host calls it the normie contract, where you're able to start as low as possible by giving them the maximum raises. And because of their proximity to the aprons, they need as much flexibility as possible. So starting each contract as low as possible was important. So they start at 10.7, and that brings them right very close to the tax as things stand. So I figured that they would probably still try to figure out something at this point to get under it later, especially because of the next contract that they did. They agreed to terms the next morning with Jordan Goodwin. This one, I was saying I had a kind of a tough time trying to nail. I was kind of close about, I just put in what the biannual exception was projected as. So roughly $5.5 million a year, $11 million over two. I felt like 2 years was fine. Essentially what Marcus Smart got with the Lakers last year. The market for this type of player, like a good reserve perimeter, like defensive guard who like good hustle guy, like it was kind of all over the place, where Goodwin ended up getting $6.3 million a year on a three-year deal, $19 million. Alvarado got like $4.5 million or $4.6 million a year. And then you got Keon Ellis making $9 million a year. Each player, like they're all a little different from each other, but they, for the most part, they all kind of serve the same kind of like general function in a rotation, minutes wise. So I would say like this deal and the Alvarado deal definitely much more favorable. I think this one's like pretty okay. I mean, yeah, how do you feel about this deal?
Yeah, I liked this one too. Again, it's not a deal that's necessarily you're going to go out and get some positive piece for if you try to trade him later on. But Goody represents everything the Suns want to be about in terms of grit and toughness, offensive rebounding. He was the best offensive rebounding guard in the NBA last year, pretty much. So I think he's exactly what they want. And you couple that with his improvement as a three-point shooter. He shot 37% from three on pretty decent volume for a guy coming off the bench. And he did show signs of being able to do that the year prior in LA as well, even though that was like a 29-game stint or whatever it was. It is something that hopefully he's going to be able to build on. But it's pretty good value for him. It's not anything that's going to hurt you later on down the line, I don't think. And like I said, he embodies everything that they want their identity to be about. So it makes sense that they brought him back.
Yeah, I don't really have too many notes. It's basically within the standard deviation I had. I don't mind that it's a little longer with the player option. Should be tradable. Not sure they're going to get a lot of stuff for him that if it comes time to trade him, but they should be able to move him. Normie structure starts at $5.9 million, and that puts them into the tax. So at this point, I'm starting to wonder, like, would they do something to cut measures? Would that mean maybe trading Jalen Green for someone making a lot less? That's something you and I discussed. Or do they potentially not bring back Mark Williams, look into sign and trading him? And this came next, I believe, in terms of the agreements. I think this came right before the Miles Bridges trade. Mm-hmm. And they ended up bringing him back. And I think I understand why. So I was way off on the big man market, particularly for reserve big men. I thought that guys like him and maybe even like Derek Lively on his upcoming extension could get like close to like $18 million a year. So I was way off on that market. The other thing is that with Mark Williams, they were doing better with Osui Godaro, and then they have a big investment to develop Kaman Malwa. So I'm thinking, like, you know, he's definitely not like, he's a little more expendable from the other top free agents that they were looking to bring back. So I felt it was logical. If there was going to be a guy they don't bring back, it's him, so that they could deduct the tax. Maybe you can get some value for him in a sign and trade. I think you and I sent him to the Bulls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so to their cap space, got like some crappy first. So he ended up getting much less. He got about $12.7 million a year. So I just, based on how much lower it came out, I'm just kind of biased to say I like it a lot. I think that's a pretty good rate for a guy who I still think he's like a solid reserve moving forward. Maybe he starts, but now at this amount that he's making, I think you don't have to like feel obligated to start him. And I think that would be his, like, I think that's kind of where he projects like a very high end backup big. And at this amount, I think that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's a great value contract in and of itself. I still have questions about how they're going to manage those three centers for the upcoming season. I think Mark Williams, unless Kaman just has an eye-opening training camp, kind of like he did, had an eye-opening summer league. I think Mark Williams is still the starter on opening night, but I'd been reporting this for a while. There is some internal optimism that Kaman Malawach could surpass him as a starter by the end of next season. So if that winds up being the case, it's good that you signed him to this type of contract that, again, a lot of these contracts, not positive value in terms of going out and getting you a piece, but something that you could probably move as long as he doesn't have a very injury-riddled season coming up, which is definitely on the table. And I think that's part of the reason they got him at that price tag, on top of the fact that they have a very crowded center rotation. But I am hopeful that signing into this deal does not mean that Kaman is limited to very, you know, short stints. I hope that this doesn't impact Osui Godaro, because like you mentioned, the Suns' net rating after the calendar flip to 2026 was way better with Oso on the court than it was with Mark Williams. He kind of had a tale of two seasons there in terms of being very positive impact the first half, and then the second half, not a good impact, and was, you know, injury prone for most of that stretch. He missed all of their playoff series. So I still think there's a good player in there. Like you said, he's only 24 years old, so there's still something you could tap into, especially at that price tag. But I do have questions moving forward about how they're going to manage all three of those guys who should probably see the floor in some capacity.
My only, I guess, knock is that it wasn't a longer deal, but I'm sure, like, to get him at this rate, that he probably wanted to keep it as short as possible. So that's pretty reasonably long to get him locked into that amount. So I understand him taking the security versus the $9.6 million qualifying offer. And then you touch on something I was going to go on to next. Does this help him with his trade value? And I would say this contract, I think this is so far the best contract they sign of the three. I think this should give them positive trade value. I don't know if they'll get like a first round pick, but they could definitely get like a lot of seconds, depending on how like maybe 3-4 seconds in the future. So definitely tradable. There's going to be teams in need of big men in the future. And on that deal, especially now, if Oso makes another step, and Kaman finally starts to show the signs that and starts to need regular playing time, they could get to a point where they might be open to moving Mark Williams. And I think and that could also be their way to potentially get under the tax this year. If if he becomes like so expendable in that sense, maybe you could look to trade him and then, you know, one more player, get out of the tax. That would probably be if they're like maybe not heading towards the playoffs, if they're maybe in like the bottom of the 9-10 playoff mix. We'll see. We could get into predictions later, but you know, they do have an out to get under the tax later if needed.
Right.
So then they, after all this, they're pretty deep in the tax, well over the first apron and just $4.3 million below the second apron with a full 15-man roster. So I'm kind of, and I think they had like a $61 million tax penalty for this roster. So at this point, I'm kind of thinking, I mean, that's kind of it. They're probably mostly done. Not much. They brought back their guys. They have like a full rotation. And then the next day, they made maybe one of the more shocking, like gut reaction types of provoking trades of the offseason. So we predicted, I mean, I won't say predict. We came up with a trade to kind of understand the type of trade we could see the Suns doing, where you get an upgrade. So we pick, we went with Santi Aldama from the Grizzlies, and we structured it where they sent out Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal in the 2033 first round pick. And this wasn't necessarily an endorsement for us to do it. It's more to show the type of trade of how the Suns could make the best upgrade they can, because the draft equity of the 2033 first round picks really like their most valuable non-player asset by far. They don't really have any other first round picks to trade. They have some seconds after that. And that's a very valuable pick, one that far out. And on top of that, they were going to send out some negative money. So we had them getting back a pick to kind of help with the value, because it'd be similar to what they did, was it 2 years ago now or last year, when they traded a distant first round pick for three lesser value ones with the Jazz. That opened up more trade functionality. Mm-hmm. So this trade, it assumed that we already got the Suns under the aprons, under the tax. I think we traded Jalen Green to save a lot of money, and we let Mark Williams go in a sign and trade. So they would have only needed to, they could have taken back, send out less money than what they were taking back. This was a $9.1 million trade exception. But since they were operating above the aprons in real life, when they did the Bridges trade, he didn't make that much more than Aldama, they actually had to do a dollar-for-dollar match. They do that with Allen and Royce. And so to the Suns' credit, they at least understood that that 2033 first-round pick is more valuable than Bridges, that they get a future first back, although it's going to be a lesser of three teams. Funny enough, they actually traded this pick to the Hornets originally in the Mark Williams trade. So now they got it back. They also get the 2027 second-round pick. Obviously, there's value in moving off of Allen and O'Neal, so that's baked in as well. Mm-hmm. And they saved about $30 million in like total savings, so there's that, get a little more flexibility. With that said, I think they did not get the player they were hoping would make the sort of impact they were hoping for. And I'm not sure there's a player that significantly changes that. Like, even Aldama, I don't think helps with that. But yeah, I'll just kind of leave the floor for you. What was your whole thought process when this happened?
I hated this trade on every front imaginable, to be honest with you. I've been writing and talking about this nonstop over the offseason. I'm sure Suns fans are probably sick of me at this point. But yeah, from an off-court perspective, and I don't think that should be ignored, bringing in a guy after, you know, you spent the whole last year telling fans that you want to reset the culture, that you want to field a team that fans are proud of and all this stuff, bringing in a guy with Bridges history, the felony domestic violence charge that he pled no contest to, that is a really tough sell just as a starting point. And it's been very divisive among the fan base here, as I'm sure a lot of Hornets fans had to deal with over the last few years as well. On top of that, giving up the 2033 pick. Look, we came up with that Santi Aldama trade where the 2033 pick was included, but they were getting a borderline lottery pick back in this draft. The pick they're getting back from Charlotte in the Miles Bridges trade is the less valuable of four teams because I think Charlotte is now added to the mix as well. So it's probably going to be somewhere in the 20s, maybe the late teens if you get outrageously lucky. And people have brought up, well, it opens up their flexibility because now they have flexibility. They have the 2027 and 2029 picks that they can
Yeah, they
trade.
could trade two more first now.
Right, but they can still trade the same number of firsts. It's two. They had two before this trade. So it doesn't like free up more flexibility. It's the same number of picks you can trade. It's just now you have a much less valuable pick as one of those two picks because the other one is that 2027 picks that is also the least valuable of three teams. So hated it in terms of giving up the 2033 pick, even if they got a first round back and a second rounder back. They don't have like second rounders. They don't have very many. I think they have that one and maybe one or two more, if I'm right on that, because they owe their seconds to other teams through like 2033 pretty much. And then I don't like the basketball fit of Miles Bridges either. Like, I think Miles Bridges is obviously a better player than Santi Aldama. But I don't think he fit. They needed more size. They needed more rebounding. He checks out like he's on par with Royce O'Neale as a rebounder, and Royce is like 1 or 2 inches shorter. And Miles Bridges is still slightly undersized for that spot at 6'7". He does a lot of the same things that you're getting from Jalen Green and Dylan Brooks. He's not a good shooter, even though he's a willing one. He's not a good shooter. And for all the talk about him getting downhill and putting pressure on the rim, which the Suns need, he's more of a short mid-range kind of guy. Like he'll get to the 4 to 14 feet area and, hit a floater or something like that. But getting to the rim, his rim rate and his rim efficiency have all declined over the last 4 years. So like I don't like this trade from a basketball fit, from an off-court and culture perspective, or from a value standpoint in terms of what they had to give up to get it done. Like I know they've been interested in Bridges for like 2 years now. So I understand that he was a target they wanted and they maybe had some blinders on to go get him, but the Suns have to stop making deals with the Hornets because they are just getting wrecked. If you look at the history of these four trades they've made over the last couple of years, what the Hornets have gotten out of it versus what the Suns have gotten out of it is really not pretty to stand them side by side.
So the Suns are left with two tradable firsts. They could trade like if they trade their 27 and 29, that lets them trade the most amount of firsts that they can. And they got a 2027 second round pick, which is also the lesser of the same team. So they have 3 seconds in their disposable. Though I think as far as on the court, as far as what Bridges brought to the Hornets is like when you look at it, he was probably, I don't know if you could call him a negative, but he was definitely not really helping the Hornets. Like he was probably the least impactful. He was the least impactful starter. And I just, as far as like, it seems like a natural fit. You could just slot him into the four. The Suns did have a hole there, but I don't think he's going to have that level of impact that they're probably hoping. It just did not seem like a fully basketball decision. Felt like part of it also just kind of like the connection with the Michigan State thing. And so the question is there like a guy out there, if it was going to be a four, that would have changed your that would have changed how you felt about like the positional upgrade? Because I looked around a little bit, not a lot of fours within that salary slot. Because if you're trading Allen and Royce, that's 29 million, so you can't go higher than that. Like Aldama, he again, like same thing, he wasn't going to make like a huge impact. Even if they got like Naz Reid at the highest end, if that was possible, or like Aaron Gordon, which is a guy that I discussed on your show, I think he would have made a lot of sense on the Suns. You're still overpaying on the value so much that I still don't feel like that much better. You might feel, I think like adding two of those guys would like definitely win you a couple more games, give you a little more playoff equity, just not enough to justify the cost, I think. Anyone else you had in mind?
Yeah, I came up with a couple of trades the other day on Suns After Dark of trades I would have rather them tried instead of the Miles Bridges trade. An interesting one that would have been complicated and probably had to be done in two parts would have been signing and trading Mark Williams away to the Bulls and then lumping yourself in with that Timberwolves Hornets framework to get Julius Randle out of it instead of the Brooklyn Nets. And that one was pretty complicated, but essentially the Hornets would still get Grayson and Royce, the Suns would get Julius Randle and that 20 number 28 pick I think that Brooklyn wound up getting. And then the rest of the trade would be pretty similar if I remember correctly in terms of what the Timberwolves and Hornets got. But Julius Randle was one, Cam Johnston was another one. I feel like the Nuggets really wanted to dump him somewhere and then they kind of switched gears as far as all right, well, I guess we're just going to be in the second apron now. Maybe that's because they couldn't find a taker for Cam Johnson, but I would have rather them had done nothing and just started Rashear Fleming for the upcoming season because I'm high on Fleming's potential. And I feel like this kid needs minutes to grow. And I think he would have been a better fit in terms of being a bigger fit for that four spot, a guy who can actually shoot the three ball, and someone who does not need the ball in his hands to be effective. He's more of a 3-and-D glue guy, which is what that starting unit needs. Now you've got a bunch of non-shooters, and all three of Devin Booker's co-stars are guys that need the ball in their hands, have tunnel vision, and are not great perimeter shooters. Like it's just a terrible fit around Booker. So I would have rather, honestly, than make the Miles Bridges trade, I would have rather sacrificed a few wins in terms of talent and let Rashear Fleming just start, or hell, even keep Grayson and Royce at this point because I'm just not sold on the fit at all, especially since they had to attach the 2033 pick to get it done.
I mean, I would have traded a lot. I would have blown up the Suns. I would have traded all their guys and just get the draft picks. But you know, that's not what was going to happen. It was never going to happen. But did you have in those trades, like the Randle one or Cam Johnson one, for example, did you have them trading their 2033 pick?
I don't think I did in the. No, I don't think I did in either one because the Nuggets were trying to get off of Cam
Okay.
Johnson. And you could argue that Grayson at this point isn't the better player. And then I think for Randle, like the Timberwolves were pretty desperate to get Randle off their books so they could make the LaMelo ball
Okay.
move. And they didn't, they did. The one hang up on the trade was obviously the fact that when the Timberwolves traded Randle, they traded that 28th pick along with him, but they did get the 33 pick in return. So they traded down five spots. The Suns wouldn't have been able to offer something like that unless they had included that pick, which
Okay.
I don't think you're giving up that 2033 pick for Julius Randle at age 29 or 30, whatever he is now.
Yeah, I guess the question is, would the Hornets have taken on Allen and Royce? Because as far as trading Allen Royce and Mark Williams to make the money work for Randle, that works. I just don't know how interested the Hornets are without
Yeah, so
doing the,
Mark.
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry. Mark would have gone to the Bulls. I think the Hornets. I just went with it because they wound up trading. Obviously, the big get for Miles Bridges was the 2033 pick, but you know they want to shoot threes. Royce and Grayson can't help them in that respect, and they're still getting the LaMelo Ball trade done, so they're getting Naz Reid and all those picks on top of it. So it seemed like a fair swap all around, and then they still have to figure out what they're doing with Miles Bridges and trade him elsewhere, but. Seeing as how that was the return for Miles Bridges that they were willing to take, you know, maybe that changes if the 2033 pick isn't attached. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. If there was a way they could have, like, I'm not a Randle guy, but if they could have gotten him without trading the 2033 first, yeah, I'd much rather have done that for sure. Either way, I don't think there was like a target out there that really was going to, like really push them much forward above where they're currently standing. So after all that saved them a bunch of money. Temporarily, I was thinking, okay, maybe they are going to duck the tax. Maybe they are going to do that. Maybe mid-season, that's like a Mark Williams trade or something. And then they went and signed Luke Kennard, which I liked. I thought he'd get a little bit more than this. 2 years, he got 2 years, 12.4 million, player option for 6.4 million the second year. Since they were above the first apron, at the time of the signing, then they're designated with using the tax mid level. So that is the maximum amount that they could give Luke Kennard. So clearly, like, money isn't an issue with the Suns, which I respect this year. And I thought Kennard would get like a pay cut of some sort. I thought he might get closer to like $9 million a year or like the Rue mid-level exception. They got him for less than that, 6.2. So I think that's kind of a no-brainer signing, just if you could, to get him for that amount. Very limited options out there. I feel like this is a pretty steal, only 3.7% of the cap.
Yeah, no, I liked that acquisition. It's great value as well. You know, with the Miles Bridges trade, they traded two of their three best three-point shooters away, and Miles Bridges is not a good shooter. So bringing in a guy who ranks second all-time in three-point efficiency is a good way to address that concern. I still have a little concerns about the Suns' three-point shooting outside of Gillespie and Kennard, because Kennard is a low-volume shooter. He averages like three attempts per game. That's not really going to cut it, even coming off the bench, to make up for the three-point shooting you lost, especially in terms of the volume that Grayson and Royce were putting up. But just the contract itself, very good value, like you said. I thought he might go for a little bit more. So to get him for the taxpayer MLE is good value. And he has, you know, a little bit of playmaking juice as well. I think him, Colin Gillespie, and Oso in that second unit are going to be really hard for opponents to guard, just because of all the movement and basketball IQ out there. Some of the quick hitting actions and movement shooting that Gillespie and Kennard can do with a playmaking big like Oso. So that'll be fun to watch. I think honestly, the fit of the second unit makes a lot more sense to me than the starting lineup for the Suns right now.
It makes sense, because I think the one thing about the Aldama trade was to address the shooting, and so they don't with the Miles Bridges trade, but then they, you know, that getting Luke Kennard at that amount doesn't address it all. You mentioned the volume, but it's definitely like a good solution with the limited resources that they have. I like to consider him the greatest statistical three-point shooter of all time, because he had more volume than Mark Price. I mean, not Mark Price, Steve Kerr. I don't know. I'm always like confusing them, and because Mark Price is first in free throw percentage.
Right.
The intrigue with Kennard is always that, you know, for hit that he makes like almost every three, at least like, you know, close to 50% on average. And for most teams that had him, that was like very intriguing for the playoffs, except he hadn't really been playable in the playoffs. And until this past playoffs, when he literally won them a game against the Rockets, like very important for the Lakers. So I understand why like teams kind of they kind of wear down on him quickly after one playoff series when he was making like 12, 13 million a year. Now at 6 million a year, there's no pressure at all to play him significantly in the playoffs. So just like a great value for the regular season. And if he can have like one or two games where he has like, he just comes out of nowhere and wins a game for them, then that's great. Like, but 6 million a year, that's lower than I thought than he'd get. So again, like another great signing. I think they did pretty good for the most part with negotiating with free agents.
Yeah, no, I would honestly. So I know that you want to blow up the Suns, and I get it, because I don't think I agree with you that they're not going to win a title in the Devin Booker era with the trajectory that they're currently on. And I don't think they have the flexibility to change much about that. So I understand the inclination to blow it up. If you're not going to blow it up, though, and you're trying to be as competitive as possible, I would really love the summer that the Suns had from an offseason perspective, except for that one trade. Like, they got pretty good value on all their free agents. They got Luke Kennard in, and I understand getting Luke Kennard at the MLE wouldn't have been possible without the Miles Bridges trade and some of the money that it freed up, but like, that one trade is just a really hard sell, and it kind of did poison the vibes heading into the season for a lot of Suns fans out here. So I would be much higher on their offseason without that one move that they made.
Yes, and when you look at the West, a lot of people, like, the East seems like it's going to be more competitive from like 1 through 11. Like, there'll be a lot more of those middle of the pack teams that are doing, probably finishing over 500. Where in the West, it seems like pretty wide open after the top six, which I think a lot of people assume is going to be the same top six as last year. So in no particular order, what is that? OKC, Spurs, Lakers, Rockets, Denver, and
Timberwolves.
And Timberwolves. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like 6 through 7 through 10, I feel pretty confident that it will include Phoenix, Utah, Portland, and not the Warriors, not the Clippers. There's like one other team I feel pretty good. Dallas. I feel pretty mm-hmm. good about Dallas. So I think the Suns, with this roster that they put together, they'll probably be like similarly competitive as last year. Now it'll be their second year with this group. So if you're looking at the lens, how are they going to be against that play-in group? You could say, well, you know, Utah still kind of figured things out. They just got this roster together. They lost Walker Kessler. Dallas, they are still very young, and too much versatility. Maybe they could use a little more playmaking, a little more shooting, even though they did work on that. Portland, just like a lot of, and seems like internal distress. Oh, yeah. And that too, like it's kind of a new fit. That's a new thing they got to integrate, a new coach, mm-hmm. new player, new system, probably. You can look at the Suns of having like a pretty good chance of at least repeating what they did last year. And if things really break right, they are very healthy, maybe they could crack the top six. Mm-hmm. So with this roster, they are in the repeater tax. So they have a $50 million tax penalty. They had just waived Haywood Highsmith yesterday. He's got a $1 million partial guarantee. They could stretch it still. They have until the end of the month to stretch it. It would divide this by three. They haven't enough. They could still add a little bit more stretched money. It's usually the limit is 15% of the cap. So they could stretch it if they want. And this is pretty much kind of back where they started after the Mark Williams signing. They are above the first apron, below the second apron. They're hard capped to the second apron because they aggregated salaries to match for Miles Bridges. And so they have plenty of space to sign 10-day contracts, add a 15th player. They're not really going to be able to increase their payroll other than signings, because they have to do 100% matches in trades. And that's kind of where they're left off heading into the trade deadline. We'll get into a little later. We have one more deal to discuss, though, the Dylan Brooks extension. Another one where I would say it's more of a prediction. Like, this is where I saw it going. I thought 3 for $75. He could have gotten a max of 4 for $125. But 3 for $75 is the sweet spot I thought he'd get, because he's technically would be making more money than he ever did. It's like a little bit more than his previous high, but it's the same general percentage of the salary cap. Like with Gillespie, the Suns go under my projection by exactly $2 million. Normie structure. How do you feel about this deal?
I think there's the potential that by the, you know, last year, second to last year, the deal, maybe it's looking a little iffy, but I think it makes sense for right now. You know, a source that I spoke to earlier this offseason told me, in terms of a Dylan Brooks extension, they might be okay with adding on, you know, maybe one more year than they normally would, just because they feel like what he brings off the court is just as valuable as what he brings on the court. They're not expecting him to have a career year like he just did last season, every season of this contract. But they believe that toughness, that locker room leadership, those are things that don't age. So I think it's a good deal. It's not, you know, it might be tough to move the second to last year if you're trying to move it by then. He's no longer playing at a high level. But I don't know. I feel like his game should age reasonably well. It's not built on athleticism by any means. So, you know, you're going to be paying him through his age 34 season. So he'll probably be in his twilight at that point. But yeah, it's not a bad deal. And I think it makes, like you said, the Suns like to reward players that come in and have good years. And I honestly do think it helps as far as building their reputation around the league as a team that will reward its players, and contributes to it being more of a destination where guys want to come play, where guys like Luke Kennard maybe take less than they could get somewhere else to come play here. So I think it makes sense. It's not a bad deal. And Dylan Brooks is a core part of what they're trying to build now.
So I think I've seen mostly negative, not stuff said, but like I think most people felt. I think like the consensus, like slight consensus, is that this will end up being a negative value deal. I'm definitely higher on it than most. Yes, he'll be 34 when this deal ends, but when you look at the percentage, roughly a little over 13% of the cap for a very good defensive starting level wing that who's like a fifth option on most teams. The main downside I have is if he like slips on defense, because if he does, like, and that could happen as he gets a little older, but like most players would have already kind of had that slippage by now as they get more of an offensive role, the defense goes away, and he just remains like a very consistently good defender at his age 30 season. So maybe there is some slippage, but I feel pretty confident he's going to remain. It won't be like too much. So you can look at a comparatively he's making more than guys like Josh Hart, but I think this is kind of what the going rate's going to be for this type of player. I could see Lu Dort getting a similar type of contract, just because there aren't many players like these kind of, like that. It's very hard to get high level perimeter defenders. And the other thing people might note at is, okay, he had this very like look probably an outlier offensive season where he was like borderline an all-star, and I don't think anyone expects him to do that. But he doesn't need, I don't think he needs to repeat that for this contract to be good, because he was meeting the value of this contract in his first 2 years with the Rockets when he was averaging like 13 points per game. Like people felt that contract was gonna be bad from the get-go, and he was like immediately so productive for them, so helpful, that he was. If like no one was complaining about that contract, I'll just say that. So he's basically making the same contract as that, just with the just higher with the cap going up. So I'm optimistic. I like this deal more than most, and the decision's basically you either pay him this or you trade him. Like I said, I would have traded. I would gone a different direction with the Suns roster if I could have, but since that wasn't the decision, they gave him this extension. I think it's reasonable. And I think should be tradable in the near future. I don't know. Again, I don't think they're going to get like a haul. Maybe they could get like a first round pick for him in the future. But I think it's movable.
Yeah, no, I think so too, and I think, I hated the deal that the Rockets gave him. I didn't think it was going to be good value at all, and he just continues each new stop that he goes to, Memphis, Houston, and now Phoenix. He goes there, the team is competitive, it wins games, he helps establish the culture. There's no like number that you can really attach to that on the stat sheet in terms of the value of that. So it makes sense that the Suns wanted to reward a guy like that who's kind of foundational in this new culture that they're trying to establish, this new night-to-night identity. And it's one that we saw last season. And when Dylan Brooks was out with his fractured hand, you noticed a difference in terms of the grit and the intensity being dialed down a little bit. So he still is very important to that, even after with a year under his belt here. And so I think it makes sense to reward that. And like you said, it's not, I don't, it could become a negative asset by like the last year or second to last year, maybe, but I still think he'll have value at that point.
So last thing then, have you started looking ahead into what they could do as they approach the trade deadline?
Not yet. I'm still trying to get my bearings on this new starting lineup and how they're going to play all these guys. And, obviously they just waived Haywood Highsmith yesterday. So does that mean they're going to bring someone in or just retain flexibility? Because they have done that in the past where they've left that 15th roster spot open for trades or for, to bump up a two-way signing to a full roster deal. So still trying to get my bearings there. I will probably have to start putting together some Jalen Green trades, definitely some Miles Bridges trades for, when those December, January, trade eligibility deadlines hit. But yeah, it's I just don't like the fit of that starting five. I think something's got to give between either Green going to the bench or being traded or Bridges, same thing. It just there's too much of the same thing in that starting five.
My thing that I'm keeping an eye on is one, the luxury tax, if they're, let's say, kind of like a 7-8 seed, which is kind of like the, I guess, the median reasonable outcome for how things could be looking at, as they head into the season, maybe they look into getting under the tax. But also because any trade they do most likely is going to have them lower, decreasing their salary. So let's say they do that type of Jalen Green trade that you and I speculated on. Like if they trade for DeJounte Murray, who's making like $6 million less, there's like a handful of other guards making like in the $30 million range. They could do something like that. If they view that as an upgrade coupled with maybe they do the Mark Williams trade, if Malawach is playing well enough, so that could help. That could be their path to getting under the tax. And then maybe also getting some type of upgrade at the one. I would just anticipate like it'd be more whatever changes they make. Like you can't really point that and say this is gonna like change everything. Like even if DeJounte, like again, because we did the DeJounte Murray trade, I think that helps them a little bit just as far as the fit goes, but I can't say it structurally changes everything, especially while they still have like Miles Bridges there at the four. So depending on how they do, I could see them just kind of shifting pieces around just mainly to save money, but, and hopefully like it gives them some type of boost wherever they feel needed.
Yeah. I mean, the Suns internally are very high on Jalen Green, especially because he's still only 24. They're big believers in him finally figuring it out with a healthier season. I don't know if I agree with them on that assessment, but that's just kind of where their heads are at. And as much as I hate the one trade that they made to kind of shake up their roster a little bit and bring in an upgrade at the four spot, they were very big on continuity and the belief that this group, if we have a healthier season, year two under Jordan Ott, another year of familiarity with mostly the same pieces intact, we'll be able to build on our 45-win season. So I'm sure there are a lot of people that are skeptical they'll be able to do so. The West is still very difficult, and now with the new draft lottery reforms, you're not going to be facing teams that are resting guys in January, February the same way that you have in years past. So I think that's going to be more difficult than maybe they think, but I can't rule it out either. I think Bridges is technically an upgrade over Royce O'Neal at the four spot, just individually. So they do have a little bit more talent at their disposal. And, you know, this is the first year in quite some time that the Suns are heading into a new season with basically the same core coming off a feel-good year. Like the last few years, they were constantly shuffling pieces to make it fit around Kevin Durant, to make it fit around Bradley Beal, constantly swapping role players and vet minimum guys and everything under the sun. So at least this year you have most of your core that's still the same, and you can build on some of that chemistry and continuity that was there last year, especially when you were healthy. So that, I guess that's kind of the approach they took this offseason, yeah, both from a team building perspective and from a salary cap perspective, because they didn't have a ton of options to go out and make big moves again. And I think that made sense, just minus that one bad trade.
In the beginning of the offseason, my feeling was that the Suns are heading in a downward trend for the upcoming season, because they mostly retained guys, so not necessarily improved. And then you and I explained we don't think the Miles Bridges trade helped. But I now feel a little more optimistic for them compared to the other teams in that tier I'm setting them up to be, because I think there's a lot more downside now for some of these other teams. The Warriors mainly, they did not do anything. I think they're going to be pretty bad this year. The Clippers, it was like the Suns did all their stuff before they traded, Clippers traded Kawhi, so it was still kind of up in the air what's going to happen there. Clearly the Suns are better than both those teams. And then I think you look at Portland, like they may have gotten worse, honestly, like with that John Morant trade. Like, okay, they didn't give up any assets, but like that's a big structural change for like their play style. I don't think it addressed playmaking, but that's like about it. Like they already have a downhill driving force in Denny Avdia. I'm kind of dubious how, like, why you need two of those types of guys. how that fits. So like, I think there's some downside with the Blazers, plus the, you know, they did the another coaching change and all the stuff internally. Like, I think there, like, I would say there's a, so much, the downside, like, across the West kind of outweighs the Suns, quote unquote, complacency, even though they weren't complacent. They were pretty aggressive in bringing back their guys and getting in additions, that I feel more confident in their ability to, like, to remain in the high, the top of the play-in mix. As long as they're healthy, they should more or less repeat what they did last year, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And last year, they, you know, if not for the play-in tournament game against the Blazers, they would have been the seventh seed. They won more games than Portland last year as well. Denny just went off, and Devin Booker had a terrible game in that play-in game. So, you know, that's prone to happening now with the play-in tournament. But I think they'll probably finish in that same range. Could crack the top five or six if everything breaks right, like you mentioned.
All right, Gerald, this was a lot of fun. I appreciate you joining as always. You got anything you want us to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, sure. I'm still plugging away, writing a couple articles a week over at Suns After Dark and doing my weekly podcast over there. Just had Mike D'Antoni on the show. So if you guys are interested ahead of his Hall of Fame induction, make sure to go check that out over at Suns After Dark. And then I'm also writing a weekly freelance article for Sports 360 AZ covering the Suns as well. So even in the dog days of summer here in August and September, still coming up with as much creative content as I can to keep you guys, you diehard Suns fans, entertained. So make sure to check it out. And you can follow me on socials at Gerald Borge.
And everyone, make sure you subscribe to Suns After Dark. Great Suns content there. And if you're new here, please subscribe to Third Apron, wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe to the Substack and follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky as well. My Yossi Goslin, for instance, salary cap analysis as soon as all transactions happen.